Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our community, as Dr. Page and Goldstein specialize in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. And now, Your Health.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
And I'm Dr. Christy Page.
And on our show today, Christy, we've got some really fascinating research that matters, some great house calls, and we're going to be beginning a two-part series on physician-assisted death with a conversation with Dr. Timothy Quill, professor of medicine, psychiatry, and medical humanities at the University of Rochester Medical Center, who will start the conversation about options at the end of life, a conversation that we were able to facilitate with one of our colleagues, Dr. Michael Baca-Atlas. Really looking forward to this first part of this conversation.
And me as well. But first, we have some research that matters, Adam. We've got great ones today. We're going to talk about, do gun restrictions help reduce gun deaths?
We're going to talk about non-steroidal anti-inflammatory agents, pretty much all of them, and the risk of heart attacks.
We're going to talk about interventions to minimize high-risk prescribing of things like these anti-inflammatory medications and how that can cut emergency admissions.
And finally, we're going to talk about in-car breathalyzers, or laws called mandatory interlock laws. These sounds kind of interesting. I can't wait to talk about it. Important research.
I know. I want to be sure we get to that last one. Okay, so gun restrictions. We've talked before on the show about gun laws and gun violence, and have had many conversations about this, Adam.
And we try to tease through the research that is on these issues and what the research shows, and is this an association or is this causal and where things are going. And this is another piece of that puzzle. It was research in the journal Epidemiologic Reviews.
It was research done at Columbia University's Mailman School of Public Health, where they did one of these systematic reviews. They looked at 130 different studies conducted from 1950 to 2014 in 10 different countries. And they looked at the countries who had overhauled their gun law, and mostly in the developed world, and then compared to see if there were results in decreased rate of gun deaths.
And they did see a reduction in firearm death rates after the enactment of firearm legislation. And it tended to be more specific laws, such as background checks or rules on storage, that reduce specific types of gun deaths, including being killed by a partner or unintentional firearm injuries and deaths of children. So those would make sense based on those legislation.
Right. So there was some decrease in homicide and suicide. When you look at these big population studies, it's hard, their associations, it's hard to say that one thing necessarily led to another. And as they reviewed changes in firearm policy, it didn't hold true for all changes. So if it was just about being able to conceal your weapons or other related laws, it didn't necessarily have the same effect. And it was hard to tease those things out.
Like some of the legislation called Stand Your Ground laws that makes it easier perhaps for people who have weapons to use them or defend themselves in those situations actually did not have any effect on gun deaths, or in some cases perhaps they even had an association with some increased violence. So I think this is a piece in the puzzle. It's an important piece. And this conversation, I'm sure, Christy, will be continuing. We'll be revisiting it again. A good research.
Well, let's talk about common painkillers or anti-inflammatory medications. These, sometimes you'll hear doctors refer to this as NSAIDs, non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs.
Otherwise known as Metoprin, Neupren, Aspirin,
Ibuprofen, Motrin,
Aleve, Naprosyn, and
Celebrex, Diclofenac, Mobic. Okay, but these are drugs that are used to treat a wide range of diseases. Usually, it could be pain-related, inflammation-related, so muscle pain, bone pain, swelling, fever sometimes. They can be used for a whole variety of things. They're very common.
Yeah. I think we kind of use them thinking, oh, we know that they can upset our stomach. And yeah, we've heard in the distant past about this effect on heart attack risk, but should we think about it more? And this was 14 European universities in hospitals that looked at research on these and published in the European Heart Journal. And really, they gathered all the research on this and then made recommendations on this research. And it's a lot more profoundly risky with this research than perhaps I even think I perhaps realized.
Yeah. Well, we knew that these newer medicines, these COX-2 inhibitors, there was Vioxx that was pulled from the market, there's Celebrex. We knew that there was an increased risk of heart attack with those drugs, and there's a black box warning. And so that sort of brought back some of the older types like diclofenac, even just Motrin and other ibuprofen, Advil, et cetera. But they even found that even with diclofenac, these older ones, that there is an associated risk, an increased risk of heart attack, and apparently to the same extent as some of the ones that were taken off the market. So there are these risks, particularly if you already have heart disease or kidney problems, that it could be more risky for you. But I don't know about you, Adam. This makes me just take a little bit more pause, both when I'm prescribing and also even just taking it personally.
Yeah, you know, Christy, I think both of us went back and looked at what the Food and Drug Administration actually has recommended. And last year, they strengthened the warnings on these particular medications, saying that they can increase the chance of a heart attack or stroke. And they don't know, are certain ones necessarily better or worse, safer or not, but that the risk can be in those who have heart disease and in those who don't, but certainly is worse in those who have heart disease. And finally, the risk appears greater at higher doses, though it can even start at low doses when you first start them. So I think we need to stay attuned to this, but I think you're absolutely right. More caution in my own life, more caution in recommending these medications.
And if you are recommended one of these medications, certainly if you're taking one of these medicines regularly, I would bring this up with your doctor. And then if you get prescribed any medication, you should ask, is this one of those medicines that can increase my risk of heart disease, or what are the other risks associated? There's always something to add to that conversation.
And last thing, if you have heart disease or heart failure, really think twice and talk with your doctor about whether or not these medicines will be right for you.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so now let's talk about interventions this to minimize high-risk prescribing and its relationship with emergency admissions. So this was a study published in the New England Journal of Medicine that involved 33 general practices across Tayside, Scotland, that were over 200,000 patients looking at this high-risk prescribing of these NSAIDs to see if intervention to reduce that high-risk prescribing would then impact outcomes.
Yeah, 48 weeks of kind of professional education and using electronic health records to review treatment. And it led to a 37% reduction in the prescribing of these medications for people with kidney problems, heart failure, people already on a blood thinner like Coumadin. And more importantly, even than that, was they reported that the rate of admission to the hospital for bleeding from perhaps these sorts of problems was reduced from 55 to 37 admissions per 10,000 person years. In other words, it went down, and it may be due to this intervention. Those are really robust, significant findings.
I mean, impressive.
I think we need to think about doing these sorts of things in our own patients.
Sure. I mean, there may have been something else going on, but it reduced those admissions and reduced the admissions for heart failure. So there's something here that's really important, and we need to look at this for sure.
We need to be thinking about much more holistic interventions that maybe don't rely on the medications, physical therapy and stretching and meditation and yoga, so forth.
Agreed. Well, we have to talk about this next one. This is about in-car breathalyzers for people who've had a drinking while intoxicated, some sort of ruling. If you've been an offender, there are laws that can require drivers to pass a breathalyzer test before their car will start.
Yeah, these are called ignition interlocks or mandatory interlock laws. And I think we may have seen some of these devices that lock the steering wheel until your breathalyzer says that there is no alcohol.
It's amazing.
And this was in the American Journal of Public Health, and it estimates that these types of laws passed in about 20 states that actually have them has saved close to 1,000 lives. And there's a 15% reduction in drunk driving-related deaths compared to states who don't have this. I was happy to hear that North Carolina actually does have one of these laws, but there it means 30 states don't have them. So if you're one of our listeners out there in the 30 states who don't have it, we encourage you to really advocate for these types of laws. It may save your life or the life of your loved ones.
I mean, it saves lives. I mean, I think it also speaks to the need to expand breathalyzers more broadly for people to know and sort of have that information before they drive. You think about what the impact of Uber might do to reduce deaths related to drinking and driving. There's a whole variety of elements here that can make a difference as we're moving forward.
Yeah, what if the Uber driver had one of these inner lights? Oh,
yeah, I never thought about the Uber driver.
Question. Well, that'll conclude the research that matters. We've had a good research, and we're going to take a short break. And when we return, we'll be happy to really hear the conversation that Dr. Michael Baca-Atlas has had with Dr. Timothy Quill, professor of medicine, psychiatry, and medical humanities at the University of Rochester Medical Center. Part one of the conversation about options at the end of life. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein, Dr. Christy Page. We'll be right back. UNC Family Medicine's number two ranked national program is rapidly transforming healthcare through excellence in teaching, clinical care, and research. To participate in UNC Family Medicine's efforts to move innovative ideas into action, call 919-843-5112 or email yourhealth@unc.edu.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health. I'm Dr. Michael Baca-Atlas. Today on Conversations, we'll be talking with Dr. Timothy Quill, a professor of medicine, psychiatry, and medical humanities at the University of Rochester Medical Center, about options at the end of life. Welcome, Dr. Quill. Thank you so much for being with us on the show today. How are you doing today?
I'm doing very well, thank you. Glad to be here.
So we're here again to discuss options at the end of life. And my understanding is that you work, you know, primarily in the field of palliative care, and that you're a founding board member of the American Academy of Hospice and Palliative Medicine. How did you get interested in this field in the first place, and why is this work so important to you?
Well, I came to this work from my work as a primary care physician, which I was for many years. And I was also a hospice medical director when I started out in practice. So I was aware that, medicine can be very powerful. I love the fight against disease and helping people work their way through that. But I have also been very aware that sometimes that fight gets very difficult, and sometimes fighting the disease causes more harm than it does good. So this sort of led to my discovering hospice and for people who are not very responsive to usual treatments and who can accept the fact that medicine doesn't have too much to offer to them. And the corollary to that was palliative care evolved into a field to say, well, hospice can relieve pain, can relieve symptoms, can help provide added support. Why not provide that for people who are still in treatment? So we learned that you could do some of those same things for people still in treatment. They could then accept more treatment and have a richer experience and richer conversation about what treatments can do and can't do. So that was sort of palliative care coming into the picture, and then transitioning to hospice when treatments really are no longer effective.
So for our listeners, my experience in the hospital and with talking with patients, there is some confusion that seems to persist with, you know, talking with individuals about, you know, palliative care, you know, versus hospice, and there seems to be confusion. And so to clarify that confusion, sort of a brief definition for both of those, I think, would be really helpful.
Well, both palliative care and hospice take attention to treating pain and shortness of breath and depression and uncomfortable symptoms. And both provide added support and conversation about what's going on. But palliative care can be provided alongside the most aggressive treatment. So a lot of the patients that I'm seeing giving palliative care to in the hospital might be getting a heart transplant or aggressive chemotherapy. So they get that alongside good palliative treatment. So it's a both-and approach. Then hospice comes into play when treatment of the disease is no longer effective or meaningful for a particular patient. We don't have any good treatments, or they've tried all the treatments that are available. And that would be when palliative care is the exclusive focus. So the main job is pain and symptom management, support for patients and families, and helping them navigate the last part of their lives. So again, that's a much smaller group of patients. Very important subgroup, There's a whole system of care that kicks in around hospice care when people make that transition. But palliative care can be provided alongside any aggressive treatment as well. So that's the difference.
So we're here talking about end-of-life options, but even more specifically about physician-assisted death. You recently wrote an article in the Journal of American Medical Association on the subject. The first line was, is physician-assisted death ever justifiable? Yes. As a primer for our listeners, could you offer a hypothetical case or a case that you've dealt with specifically when physician-assisted death is justifiable?
Well, yeah, I think the most common scenario would be people who are getting sicker. So they've often been through a long period of treatment of their underlying disease, and that treatment is, for whatever reason, down the road now and is no longer working. So we then say, well, what options do they have then? And again, the standard of care then would be hospice care. And again, most people are quite appreciative of a hospice option, and that's acceptable to them. But some people also wonder, well, what if my suffering, despite hospice care, gets to be really tough? What kind of options do I have then? Do I have any options to perhaps shorten that period of suffering, or what kind of escape could I have? And that's where the question of physician-assisted death comes in. Most people want to know that there could be an option should they end up in that tough situation. But if they get good hospice care and good palliative care, they actually will never need it. So they like to know that it's there. There are often people who are used to being in control, but they'll never actually activate it. But a small number of people actually do get to the point where they're ready to die, and they're asking us for their help. And that's where the question of physician-assisted death comes in.
And actually, towards the end of your article, you almost state that you have an issue with the nomenclature that I've seen published around as well, that, you know, physician-assisted suicide, physician-assisted death. Why, specifically with the physician-assisted suicide, why is that choice of words, you know, problematic or difficult for you?
Well, in other languages other than English, there might be several different words for different kinds of suicide. So there's the suicide of a mentally ill patient whose thinking is distorted by their mental illness. That clearly doesn't fit for this kind of situation. There's the heroic suicide for the warrior who jumps on the mine to save his crew, and that would be a different kind of suicide. And then there might be what might be considered rational suicide, which is suicide that makes sense to certain people given their circumstances, and that might be the kind of circumstances that this particular option might be applied. So I think the folks who are opposed to this practice would like to call it physician-assisted suicide because it conflates it with mental illness. And this really, in my mind, should be separated from the kind of suicide that's associated with mental illness. Again, if somebody's requesting this, we need to carefully evaluate them to make sure they're seeing their situation clearly, that they're not having any kind of mental issue that's contributing to that thought. But you know, we know that these kinds of questions can be addressed forthrightly because we've worked with people who are choosing to stop life supports for now 25 years. Again, nobody likes to be involved in the process of stopping a life support, but we do acknowledge that people have a right to do that, that we can evaluate them, that we can talk with them about it, and that we can do it pretty well in an open system with documentation. And that's the kind of system we'd like to see for physician-assisted death.
Now, going back, I think it's about 25 years now, I read the article that you wrote, very powerful, in the New England Journal about a patient of yours. Can you share with our listeners your experience and then also really the general, you know, attitude of the medical community when you made that, public announcement, which I'm not sure had really been done in that setting before?
Yeah, this was a patient named Diane who I had taken care of for a long time as her primary care doctor, and she developed acute leukemia, and she decided that she did not want the aggressive treatment that was available for acute leukemia. She felt like that would be more than she wanted to go through, and that actually was a very tough part of the care for her because I really wanted her to try treatment. Treatment had a small but significant chance of helping her a great deal and even curing her potentially, but once I realized and she convinced me that she really knew what she was giving up, then I said, okay, well, what are the options then? And I referred her to hospice. And she said, great. She appreciated hospice care. But she also said that, you know, if her suffering gets to be really bad at the very end, she wanted to skip the last part of that, her illness. She wanted to have some choice in that process. And I had dealt with this in theoretical ways in the past, and I had dealt with people stopping life support, but I had not had somebody ask me that particular question in that particular way. So I had her discover how one goes about doing this. I had her get second opinions to make sure she knew it. That she was, her request was reasonable and rational. And I talked to my colleagues, and turns out several of them have had a patient or two in their careers like this. So I ended up prescribing some medication that she could take at a later time of her own choosing. She then lived for another 3 months after that prescription, and actually on hospice, and took some life prolonging treatments during that time because her life was still meaningful to her. And eventually, 3 months down the road, when she was near death anyway and septic and really fading, she met with me and said it was time, and I didn't have any other good answers for her, and so she took the medication. And that would have been the end of it, except that I decided that I would write about it about a year later, write an article about it. I met with her family, and they gave me permission to do this. So I wrote this article that was published in New England Journal describing this process that we went through.
And I definitely, as soon as we come back from a short break, we'll hear more about the article and the process of writing that, and also how that was received, you know, by the medical community as a whole. But we'll take a short break right now. When we return, we'll continue talking with our guest, Dr. Timothy Quill, professor of medicine, psychiatry, and medical humanities at the University of Rochester Medical Center, about options at the end of life and physician-assisted death. We'll be right back with Your Health.
Your Health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Michael Baca-Atlas. We've been talking with Dr. Timothy Quill, professor of medicine, psychiatry, and medical humanities at the University of Rochester Medical Center, about options at the end of life and physician-assisted death. Before the short break, we were discussing an article that Dr. Quill had written 25 years ago in the New England Journal of Medicine about a patient of his, and we're continuing that conversation right now. Dr. Quill, we left off about essentially, you know, when you decided to, you know, publish and write about this experience, and we're interested in hearing more about that today.
So I wrote about this patient that I just cared for, and the article that I wrote, which is a narrative, got accepted in the New England Journal. And when it was published, there was quite a firestorm around it, you know, trying to figure out, did I make the case up, or what should doctors do? At that time, prior to that time, the only case really in discussion was Dr. Kevorkian, who was kind of a way out there pathologist who was, you know, helping lots of people to die in ways that seemed kind of macabre. And this case was much more challenging, I think, in the sense that everybody could have a sense of there, but, you know, for the grace of God, go I in a certain way. So this put me in the center of that storm. There was a question about whether I made the case up. It turned out that Diane, the woman I wrote about it, donated her body to science. And about 3 months later, an anonymous tipster said where she was, and they then did an autopsy. It proved that she died in the way that I said she had died. And to make a long story short, I eventually waived my Fifth Amendment rights and testified before a grand jury who chose not to prosecute. And that was sort of the end of it for me. But it did put me in the middle of this controversy and made me a one who has been articulating this as a possibility of last resort for a long time.
I would imagine that sitting in front of that juror is a little bit stressful, you know, back when this came to be. The article is very interesting. I want to transition here for a second, you know, being, you know, not far removed from, you know, my own medical education. What are your thoughts on how, you know, palliative care, hospice, you know, end-of-life options in terms of, you know, being incorporated into medical teaching and things that, you know, just doctors in terms of having these conversations can improve upon, you know, moving forward?
Well, it's very clear we need to put palliative care, and I think there's been a lot of movements in the last 5 or 10 years toward putting palliative care more centrally into medical school education for all trainees, because anybody who's going to take care of sick people needs to learn how to manage basic pain and symptoms, need to learn how to have conversations about prognosis and about what's really going on, and then reserving palliative care as a formal field for those tougher cases where the symptoms are more challenging or the ethical dilemma are more difficult. But there should be some basic training in palliative care and hospice for all clinicians who are going to take care of sick people. And we're seeing a lot of movement in that direction right now.
We're having another guest on one of our other shows pretty soon who has an opposite view on physician-assisted death, as there are many, you know, people that do. There are concerns about coercion, the mental health of patients, as you had touched upon before, and about overall the ethics, including the Hippocratic Oath and, you know, what's expected of a physician, you know, concerning overall harm. How do you respond to critics of physician-assisted death, and does that come up in your, you know, everyday practice?
Well, I would say, first of all, there's a 50-50 split or a 60-40 split, depending on how you count it, but amongst physicians and amongst the public on this issue. So it is an area where there is not agreement on one side or the other. There's strong feelings on both sides. To me, what counts the most is the patient's views and values. The patients are the ones who are going through this, and their values count the most. So if they're wanting to talk about this, clearly we have to talk about it. On the other hand, our own values as clinicians or physicians are also important, so we shouldn't do things that we can't live with. But if we can live with it, then we have to say, okay, well, how should we respond? To me, it's okay to say no to physician-assisted death, but it's not okay to then say, well, we just can't talk with you about this, we can't help you in these circumstances. So we all agree that hospice and palliative care are the floor. And then if a person is really ready to die, then we have to look at what other options there are. And there are certain other options, like heavy sedation, like stopping life supports, that we agree upon. It's very similar conversations, very similar risks, but in point of fact, people are best protected in an open system with second opinions. And that's my own position around physician-assisted death. It should be an open system with second opinions. We now have 20 years of data from Oregon that seem to show the practice is quite safe. It doesn't undermine palliative care. Palliative care is very strong there.
So getting into these, you know, clinical interactions that you have with your patients, are the patients bringing, you know, up physician-assisted death, or is it, you know, physicians, you know, providing all the cards out here on the table, like you said, all the end-of-life options? You know, are patients asking for an immediate solution, you know, a backup plan? You know, how do those conversations play out?
So this physician-assisted death would not be something that a physician would bring up for a patient unless they really raise the question. So this is usually brought up by patients. They want to know where a doctor would stand on this issue because they're worried about things down the road, perhaps based on something they've seen or fears that they have. Most people just want to talk about it. They want to know that there could be some options if they get into a tough position. So the vast majority of this will be conversation. But there will be a small number of cases where people actually do reach a point where they're really ready to die now, and they're not dying quickly enough for them, and that's where this question comes up. And again, my opinion would be that that conversation should be out in the open. You should be able to get second opinions with experienced people, document what you're doing, and that these rare cases, we should be able to respond in a way that's consistent with the patient's values and the physician's values.
We have a little bit more time left for this segment today. If you could leave our listeners with, you know, one final thought, you know, on anything we've talked about today, what would it be?
Well, I think good palliative care and hospice are the floor. So we need to continue to work to improve them. If a patient is talking about wanting to end their life, the first place to go is to make sure they're getting the best possible palliative care and hospice. And then if they are getting those things and still suffering badly, I think we have to have as open a mind as we can possibly have. It's fine with me to say no to physician-assisted death as a last resort, but it's not fine to turn your back on those patients. So you have to find some other options that will be responsive to their circumstance. Patients and families don't have a choice about going through this, but we do as clinicians. And we have to be as forthright as we can without violating our own values.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate you being here with us on the show today and your insight and views into end-of-life options and being able to explain some of these concepts that are quite complex with our listeners. We have been talking with Dr. Timothy Quill, a professor of medicine, psychiatry, and medical humanities at the University of Rochester Medical Center, about options at the end of life. Thank you so much for being here, Dr. Quill. Coming up on House Calls, we'll be answering questions about your health. You're listening to Your Health Radio with Dr. Michael Bach-Atlas.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back to Your Health. For the House Call segment of our show today, Christy, we're going to spend a few minutes listening to your health questions and concerns.
And if you have a question you'd like for us to address on an upcoming show, send your comments to yourhealth@unc.edu. We want you to share your stories. Ask us questions. Let's see what we can talk about. But first, we'll have our executive producer, Daniel Lane, read us our House Call questions for today. Daniel?
I've read a lot about tanning beds and that they can maybe cause cancer. I do like to tan, though, so I was wondering if tanning out in the sun was any safer or if there were ways I could keep myself safe while tanning.
Well, thank you for the question. As we're moving into what will be certainly lots of tanning and lots of burns in the coming summer and season, but also people who do tan in tanning salons who are at really high risk.
It's true. And I hear what you're saying. You like to be tan. You like to tan. I have that same desire. At the same time, I have to disclose my own story in that my father died at a young age in his 40s from melanoma, which is a skin cancer caused by the sun. So I love to tan, but yet I know the truth, and it sounds like you know too, that both tanning beds and tanning in the sun are not safe. Both of them increase your risk of skin cancer, and it's not a good idea. There are ways you can be out in the sun and try to protect yourself, but if your goal is to have a suntan, it's really not a good idea. There are kinds of products that you can use, little towelettes, sprays, other things that you can do that'll give you a tan without actually changing the DNA of your skin, and that's the way to go if you want to have that look.
Yeah, we would strongly recommend that you avoid tanning beds because there really is no good outcome and there's no way to avoid the rays. And we recommend that when you're out in the sun that you wear a sunblock with a sun protection factor, SPF, of 30 or higher. You apply it liberally and apply it often, avoiding the sun during the hottest parts of the day in sun protective clothing. You can use actually natural agents that can darken the skin, and you can use these safely without going out into the sun.
Yep.
So you can have the look of tanning without actually having any exposure to harmful rays. And that's what we would recommend.
And the truth is those things have gotten so much better over the years. I think when they first came out 20 years ago or whenever, there was that smell with them and other things. But you can get products now that really give you a little bit of a glow, give you that tan feeling without either the smell or some of the streakiness or some of the things that people stayed away from before.
And we'll put a link to a recommended safe regimen to give the skin a darker color if you want without tanning. What's our very next house call, Daniel?
I was on medication for acne from my dermatologist for many years, but I've been off them for about 2 years now. I just moved, and I was wondering if my new doctor can help me get a dermatologist appointment.
Well, you certainly could use your primary care doctor in that form and fashion, and we get questions like this all the time that people need referrals. They want to see a cardiologist. They want to see a dermatologist, and maybe their health plans require a referral. I must say, we don't really like being in the business of just being kind of the referral doctor, and particularly because lots of times we can actually take care of the these problems. And so sometimes we might say, why don't you come on in, let's talk about that. Because you know what? If you know the medicines that have worked for you and they've worked in the past, there was no reason why we can't give you those same medicines. And acne is a fairly straightforward disease to do well. On the other hand, if you got a relationship with the dermatologist or doctor, we have no reason to not want to keep that relationship intact.
Sure. I think when you're moving to a new area, sitting down with your new primary care doctor and saying, okay, let's, and sometimes it's several visits, but, you know, this is my medical history. These are people who've been involved in my care in the past. And really sitting down and figuring out which specialty referrals are appropriate and are the right fit for you and what you need, and which things perhaps your primary care doctor can take care of for you. Let's take our next house call question.
I'm 75 years old and overweight, probably obese. My doctor recommended that I enter a weight loss program through his clinic, but I think I can do it on my own. She said I was unlikely to be successful, though, as I hadn't lost weight in 10 years without help. Is she correct?
Your doctor is always correct.
The doctor is sometimes right.
Well, let's think about where this question is coming from. It's probably coming from a discussion with your doctor that you are probably overweight or obese in this particular situation and that you really need to lose weight. So how's that going to happen? And if you're at a certain age, that means it's been there for a long time, which means you probably haven't been as successful as you would like previously.
Yeah, I mean, if you want to lose weight and that's a goal and you want to improve your health in that way, then I would encourage you to take all the resources you can. I mean, if there is a program there that you can participate in that might help kickstart things or reframe things or refocus your energy in what sounds like you've had trouble doing for this last little stretch, if there are resources to help you, then I would encourage you to follow through with your doctor's recommendation and use those resources.
You know, a lot of people feel they lose weight when they enter a program and then they regain it when they stop the program. That doesn't mean, though, that the program isn't necessary because it really works while you're there. The question is, then let's get you losing weight and then let's kind of figure out what the booster does. What do you need to maintain that? We have just piloted a very successful weight management program at the University of North Carolina in support and intensive coaching and linking to nutritionists and even bariatric surgeons. And you know, coordinating care and really focusing on you seems to work.
Let's take our last house call question, Daniel.
My wife was recently in the emergency room for a TIA. The workup in the ER was negative, but they told her to continue taking her aspirin and to see our doctor. She has had ulcers and bleeding in the past while taking aspirin, so what should we do?
Well, you're caught between a rock and a hard place. Mm-hmm. This is very difficult and complicated. And first off, we're sorry that you've had a TIA, but we're glad that it went away. The definition of TIA, transient ischemic attack,
means
a little block of circulation, but then it goes away.
Yeah, it's like a mini stroke. And those things can be very scary. So weighing out the risk of aspirin, which if you've had a bleed in your GI tract in the past, taking aspirin or a blood thinner can increase your risk of having a big bleed again, can be dangerous. However, having a stroke or a TIA that is more prominent or lasting is also a risk, and aspirin reduces that risk. So this is sort of this balance of, well, what's the risk of having a big bleed that ends your life or quality of life, and what's the risk of having a stroke, which could end your life or change quality of life? Very, very challenging decisions that usually involve weighing out carefully your own values, your doctor's advice, if you've had a bleed, like really understanding what was that, what is your risk of having another one,
right,
and making some decisions that are uncertain.
And you could probably calculate with your doctor's assistance, we can calculate what are the risk of each of these things and then weigh how you value those things and maybe come with an answer. We could also say, we could lower some of your other risk of having a stroke. Let's get your blood pressure under better control, your diabetes under better control, get you to lose some weight, get you to quit smoking, be exposed to secondhand smoke, and get you physically active. All these things can lower your risk without bleeding.
Well, that's just the beginning of a much more in-depth conversation. Thank you for sharing these complex questions today, and thank you for being with us today in your health. We hope we've addressed issues and concerns that are important to you and your health, and we want you to share your questions and stories. Email us at yourhealth@unc.edu, visit us online at yourhealthradio.org, follow us on Twitter, Facebook, or get our health app on iTunes.
We'd like to thank the UNC Department of Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare for their sponsorship, and our guest, interview today, Dr. Michael Baca Atlas, who interviewed our great guest today, Dr. Timothy Quill. We hope you'll join us next time on Your Health.
On behalf of Your Health, I'm Dr. Christy Page.
And I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
And we'll look forward to talking with you again next week. Take care.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your Health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
You've been listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine.